Today, it is my privilege to introduce former Attorney General Edwin Meese III. He is the man who gave me the opportunity to serve in the administration, and there are volumes that I could say about him. But I won't, because I know you want to hear him. And besides, he's been a longtime friend of the society's, and most of you know him well anyway. But there are a few things that I think should be said on an occasion like this. It's no secret that Mr. Meese has come under intense fire, in large part because of his loyalty to Ronald Reagan's agenda and his unwillingness to cooperate in the selective leak game that's often engaged in this town. Sometime last year, I was asked about the effect of this bad press on me in a personal way, and was asked what I thought about Attorney General Meese. Well, I told them that I didn't think it would have any lasting effect, and that, in my opinion, Mr. Meese had been one of the best attorney generals in this century. And I then went on to venture to predict that in not too distant future, history will reflect this fact for two reasons. First, Mr. Meese has engaged the legal community in a historic debate about the rule of law and the proper method of interpreting the Constitution. Second, and perhaps more important, unlike many men and women in politics, Mr. Meese not only talked about what was the right thing to do, he acted on what was the right thing to do. In making his judicial appointments, in arguing before the court, and in administering our law enforcement system, Mr. Meese did not hesitate to follow the principles that he espoused on the public speaking tour. It's an enormous privilege and honor to introduce to you former Attorney General Edwin Meese.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for that very warm welcome. As a matter of fact, if we're not careful, we're going to be back off schedule again, thanks to your very generous applause. But I do appreciate it very much, and I'm both honored and pleased to be able to be with you today, particularly to be back among so many good friends. You've had another excellent conference here, a reputation which the Federalist Society has received because of all the fine work that's been done over the past 6 years. As we were talking at the table here, it's amazing to see the progress that's been made in such a relatively short time. You've had quite a variety of speakers and panelists. You've had some excellent discussions and debates here. And after your rousing welcome, I almost think I ought to quit while I'm ahead. But I felt that it might be helpful to contribute just a few informal observations on this theme, the Constitution and the federal criminal law, perhaps to talk about some of the things that have happened and provide some emphasis on the various matters that have been discussed in the different panels and among the other speakers. But first, let me say that the role of the Federalist Society and the tremendous progress that has been made has been extremely important to continuing the debate, extending the debate, if you will, and to what has occurred in judicial legal and legal educational thinking during the course of the past 8 years. You have given in the various meetings, conferences, receptions, and seminars of the Federalist Society, you have given attention to some of the basic principles of the Constitution, a subject that was too often neglected before the last 8 years. You and your speakers have asked the critical questions and have raised the consciousness, if you will, of the bar and the bench on some topics that really need to be in the forefront of discussion and debate. And this is a very important role. If you think about it, many of the issues that you've been discussing today were relatively dormant until Ronald Reagan came to Washington and this administration started raising some of these questions. The Federalist Society has had a very big role in the raising of those issues. For example, the exclusionary rule, the MAP case, the interrogation of suspects, the Miranda case, were matters that too many people had accepted as irrevocable, immutable, and unable to be changed. As a matter of fact, when these cases and others were begun in the late 50s and early 60s, as the United States Supreme Court and the Supreme Courts of some of the states embarked on a fairly massive effort to change the rules of criminal procedure in this country, we had a tremendous outpouring of concern at that time from police chiefs, legislators, public officials, and the like. But as year after year, these cases remained on the books, as little legislative change was made to alter them, that whole generations of police officers, prosecutors, even judges, took office, held office, and in some cases even retired, without realizing that there was a different atmosphere, a different environment for law enforcement and criminal procedure before the cases of the 1960s. And so over the past quarter of century, there was kind of an acquiescence, then acceptance, and then virtually ignoring these as major issues. The only group that knew that something was wrong were the people of our country. And as they bridled and wrote letters to the editor and raised the issue when they saw criminals about whom there was no question of their guilt getting off on technicalities, or when they saw people out on bail returning and committing more crimes and intimidating witnesses, they knew that something was wrong. They saw over 25 years the crime rate skyrocket to increase more than 100%. Now, I'm not contending that the court decisions alone were responsible for that increase in crime, but it certainly was a factor that contributed to it. And that's why in 1980, when Ronald Reagan ran for the presidency, crime was an issue, and that's why the questions that are raised by the Federalist Society and by this administration concerning the direction of criminal law and procedure are very important ones, not only to lawyers and judges, but particularly important to people themselves. As a matter of fact, one of the major contributions I think that this administration has made has been a systematic and comprehensive study under the general aegis of Truth in Criminal Justice that was conducted by the Office of Legal Policy in the Department of Justice during the past 3.5 years. In your packets, you'll see the first volume in their reports. There'll be, I think, probably 10 or 12 of these reports that will be issued in similar form. And they go back to first principles and ask the critical questions about why these changes, these departures from the traditional jurisprudence that had led our country in terms of criminal law over the first 175 years of its existence, how they came about, how these changes have affected the conduct of law enforcement and criminal justice, and then make suggestions on how we might make changes that would return us to a more appropriate path. Steve Markman, who is known to most of you and has participated in Federalist activities in the past, spearheaded this approach, and writing on such subjects as search and seizure, interrogation of suspects, right to counsel, The judiciary's use of its so-called supervisory power to control law enforcement activity, all of these things are contained in this project, which is a great contribution to the debate on the subjects that you are entertaining here. One of the things that I think is particularly appropriate about your theme, which ties together the Constitution and criminal justice, is the implicit recognition that all government authority, including its authority to enact, administer, and adjudicate criminal laws, is derived from the people themselves through the Constitution. And I'd like to suggest that some of the same principles of constitutionalism, principles such as representation and federalism and separation of powers, fidelity to text and meaning, and so on, which are so important in other areas of government and law, are equally important and should be recognized as critical to criminal law as well. So once again, we have to look at that subject that also wasn't heard much until the last 8 years, original intent. Now, I don't think I have to define for this audience what original intent means, but I can only say it's not what's usually depicted in the news media or among some of our more liberal friends on the campuses or on the lecture platform. Original intent is not a bunch of conservatives sitting around a room with an Ouija board trying to fathom what James Madison would have said about nuclear energy, or trying to divine Alexander Hamilton's views on electronic surveillance. But original intent is an acceptance of the fact that the Constitution and its original meaning, and I think Nino Scalia, Justice Scalia, has made an important contribution to our vocabulary when he said we ought to be looking at original meaning, that there was set up a structure of government and there were set up principles of government that are immutable unless they're changed by action of the people. And I think that's what we're talking about when we use the term original intent, or more appropriately, original meaning. Well, when we apply constitutional principles to criminal law, we see that where these principles, federalism and separation of powers particularly, are violated, that's where the problems arise. And I would suggest to you that the imposition of the exclusionary rule upon the states, that the wholesale development out of whole cloth of a rule relating to interrogation of suspects were violations of both federalism and separation of powers. The constitutional concept of federalism, which is easily determinable from reading not only the Constitution but the Federalist Papers and the historical materials pertaining to that time, locate particularly more than anything else the principal exercise of law enforcement authority and the responsibility for the administration of justice in the day-to-day affairs of people at the state and local level. As a matter of fact, as you read the different papers of the Federalist, you see Madison, for example, saying that the general government is not to be charged with the whole power of making and administering laws. And by general government, he meant the central government. He said, its jurisdiction, the federal government, is limited to certain enumerated objects which concern all the members of the republic, but which are not to be attained by the separate provisions of any. And he went on to say, the subordinate governments, in other words, the states, which can extend their care to all those other objects which can be separately provided for, will retain their due authority and activity. And then he makes a very interesting observation of the importance of the states. Because he said, were it proposed by the plan of the convention to abolish the governments of the particular states, the general government would be compelled by the principle of self-preservation to reinstate them in their proper jurisdiction. Well, boiled down, what he's saying in that last sentence is, the federal government can't do everything. A principle that unfortunately a lot of people in Washington forgot during the 1930s and thereafter. And then, to go on, Hamilton himself, the great Federalist, the one who was interested, and I use the term Federalist in that sense as opposed to anti-Federalist in his historical time, but the person who was an advocate of strong central government said, the one transcendent advantage belonging to the province of the state governments is the ordinary administration of criminal and civil justice. This, of all others, is the most powerful, most universal, and most attractive source of popular obedience and attachment. He said, it is that which, being the immediate and visible guardian of life and property, having its benefits and terrors in constant activity before the public eye, regulating all those personal interests and familiar concerns to which the sensibility of individuals is more immediately aware, contributes more than any other circumstances to impressing upon the minds of the people affection, esteem, and reverence towards the government. And he said, this great cement of society, the administration of criminal and civil law, will diffuse itself almost wholly through the channels of the particular state governments. Well, how far we have come from that expression of the role of the federal government when we see how Mapp and Miranda, as decisions, and their progeny and the other decisions about the same time which imposed requirements on state governments and set a national standard for the state's administration of criminal justice, violated that concept of federalism as it imposed that national standard on matters that have traditionally, since the founding of the Republic, been left to the states. It's interesting to note in this regard that prior to 1961, when the Mapp decision was promulgated by the court, many states had considered an exclusionary rule. And it's also interesting to note that at that time, only 16 states had adopted it, while 39 had not. Well, let me also talk about the separation of powers doctrine, because this also was violated by Mapp and Miranda when the court essentially usurped legislative powers in making governmental policy rather than interpreting it. This whole idea of the courts, and this is laid out very well in one of the studies by the Office of Legal Policy, really started when the court arrogated to itself what it called its supervisory power to control the federal law enforcement establishment. You might say it started in 1910 in the Weeks case, which most of us learned in law school. But perhaps it was more expressly stated as a concept in 1943 in the case of McNabb against the United States. The OLP study, the Office of Legal Policy study, concludes that the use of supervisory power by the federal courts is an illegitimate exercise of judicial authority and frustrates the truth-seeking function of the criminal justice process. And then the study goes on to say, the executive branch should resist more strenuously this incursion upon its prerogatives and the prerogatives of Congress, and should enlist the support of Congress and the public in this effort. Well, for the courts, it was a relatively short step from the exercise of self-created supervisory power over federal law enforcement to imposing what should have been the exercise only of legislative power over state law enforcement agencies. I must say, however, in all candor, and particularly when the Legal Policy Office study suggests we engage the help of Congress in this effort to resist the imposition of supervisory powers on law enforcement by the courts, that Congress and even the executive branch have not been immune from violating or at least ignoring principles of federalism in matters of law enforcement and public safety. I don't think this was ever better presented than in the panel just before lunch, when the difficulties of trying to rationalize, on one hand, very legitimate objectives of effective law enforcement come in conflict with the constitutional mandate and the constitutional separation of authority between state and federal government. Too often, for good reasons, for very legitimate reasons, we have confused the identification of national problems with the issue of whether solutions should be sought from the federal government or would be better developed from a constitutional standpoint as well as a practical standpoint by state and local governments. If we look at law enforcement, we can see what's happened in the last quarter century here, where Congress and the executive branch are certainly guilty of pragmatic decisions which were less than totally faithful to maintaining the federalism concept of the Constitution. In 1965, President Johnson appointed a very excellent commission on law enforcement and the administration of justice. And they identified a number of problems in the police field, the court field, and the correctional field, and prescribed how those problems could be corrected. And most of the solutions indeed were recommended to be performed at the local level. But then the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act of 1968 was passed, creating the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. A good idea, in one sense, but also containing the seeds of confusion and conflict in terms of the constitutional role of the federal government. Because it put, for the first time in a massive way, the federal government into the business of providing standards, in this case from administrative regulation more than court action, and it put the federal government also into the business of appropriating money that would then be returned to local governments for law enforcement purposes. Again, no one doubted the good faith of the people involved. Indeed, the early funding proposals were to be block grants in which large amounts of money would come from the federal government and go directly to the states and the state governors and the criminal justice planning organizations they were obliged to set up under the law would then have complete freedom to use that money in accordance with the priorities and objectives that they thought were most important in their states. But as those of you who may have participated in those programs know, that didn't last for long, because pretty soon the regulations started pouring out of 633 Indiana Avenue, where many bureaucrats from other agencies had taken root, now as members of the new Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. And I certainly would not in any way disparage either their motives or the quality of their work. But there's something inherent in being part of the federal establishment that means you promulgate regulations, you require paperwork to be submitted, you have the authority and you exercise the authority to approve plans, and pretty soon we had mass confusion about who was in charge and where the priorities for state and local law enforcement would be made. In state capitals and city mayor's offices and city police commissioner and chief's offices, or again, in Washington. Well, I think that there is a great contrast between what happened in the 1960s and 1970s with LEAA and what happened in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan commissioned a similar organization, a commission, if you will, on excellence in education to look into the problem in our schools. And there this commission worked. This commission brought forth their recommendations, and again, the solutions were to be found at the state and local level, not at the federal level. But instead of creating an Excellence in Education Assistance Administration at the federal level, President Reagan sent his education secretary and sent his Department of Education and himself campaigned throughout the country. And indeed, today we find education is improving in most states and in most cities and school districts. But it's being done by people at the local level without the imposition of new regulations, new requirements by the federal government. Now, that doesn't mean we've solved all the problems with the Department of Education, because you remember the president's main goal when he came to Washington was to abolish it. But there's still hope that someday that might happen. But nevertheless, I think that the distinction, the difference in the way in which these two very important local functions were treated at two different points in time illustrates what we have, what has evolved today as this confusion about roles and responsibilities of various levels of government in terms of criminal justice and the administration of law enforcement programs. That's why today, in the midst of a very legitimate concern about drugs, we have continual calls in Congress for massive federal funding of local law enforcement and of local programs for demand reduction. In other words, instead of working out some means whereby the local authorities would be able to deal with this themselves, we have this continued call for it's the president's responsibility, or it's the responsibility of Congress, to somehow step in and supplant the taxing authority of local government and to provide the funds for things that are definitely local responsibilities. That doesn't mean there isn't a very major federal responsibility in the drug field, and there certainly is in the international, interstate, major organized crime rings. But to take federal funds to support local police dealing with local traffickers within their cities, or federal funds for local detoxification centers or local demand programs, just doesn't make very much sense, because the same Congress that's now trying to find more money to be sent to local governments has cut the funds for the Coast Guard, which was performing a clearly federal role in guarding our shores against the external threat of drug smuggling into the United States. Well, where do we go from here? Are we so far down the track that principles of federalism, separation of powers, have to be abandoned in the case of law enforcement and criminal justice because it's just too complicated to do anything else? Or because the needs of the public in terms of safety, protection against criminals are so great that we should wink or ignore these principles of constitutionalism? I don't think it is necessary to take that route. And I think that there are some ways, even though the suggestions I have are relatively modest, to restore the constitutional framework for criminal justice and law enforcement in the United States. First, I would suggest that we do pay attention to redefining the roles and to reaffirm that the primary responsibility for law enforcement is at the state and local level, as both Madison and Hamilton accepted that it should be. Now, there's certainly a federal role. Let there be no mistake. There's a federal role to handle international and interstate crime. There's a federal role to do those things where jurisdictional limits keep state and local authorities from doing. There's a federal role in providing a national center for the collection of information that can only be done on a nationwide basis and for disseminating that information. There's a national role in the training and the special assistance and in the technological development, which the benefits of which go to and cover the nation as a whole, and which are beyond the capabilities of any one level of small jurisdiction or any one even large jurisdiction at the state and local levels of government. But at the same time, we ought to make sure that we keep more in mind when congressional legislation is proposed that there are distinctions between what the federal government should do and what should remain with state and local governments. Because just as these large amounts of money are being proposed in Congress for the states and for local governments, and many mayors and many governors would be only too happy to have additional funds for law enforcement, nevertheless, at the same time, they are talking about the additional requirements, the additional federal mandates that will go with those funds. Secondly, I think we do have to address the fiscal problems of local government, particularly in law enforcement. Over this last 20 or 30 years, so many new federal programs have been introduced, of which the federal government pays part and the cities pay part, that the share going for law enforcement and public safety in many places has gotten smaller and smaller as they went into all other kinds of fields like housing and welfare and a variety of other functions, which, while important, are nevertheless, at least in my mind, secondary to the critical first priority of government, which should be to protect the lives and property of its citizens. But I think there is something the federal government can do if the congressmen and the senators were serious about addressing the fiscal plight in terms of drugs and other law enforcement issues. I think they could find a way to do so in a manner other than taxing at the federal level and then doling out monies to local governmental bodies. And that is, why not allow states and local governments to raise their taxes and make whatever they do under such programs qualify as a direct offset or tax credit to people on their federal income tax? It's a way of providing more money at the local level without, at the same time, having that money first come to Washington through the federal taxing power and then come back to state and local governments with a little taken off for bureaucratic administrative costs and with a lot of regulations and additional mandates imposed. You know, in this regard, I can't help tell the story that I'm sure most of you know about the little boy who wanted a bicycle and it was going to cost $100. He wrote a letter to God. He said, "Dear God, I need $100 for my bicycle. Please send it to me." And he addressed the letter to God, and having been brought up in this central government era, he addressed it, "God, Washington, D.C. Well, it got back here, the post office. They didn't know quite where to send it, so for some reason they sent it to OMB. And it was received there, and everybody thought it was kind of cute, and so they took up a collection. They were able to raise $50. And they sent it to the boy's parents and asked them to give it to him and say that it was the response from God. Well, this prompted the boy to write another letter. "Dear God, thank you for the $50. It will help to obtain the bicycle that I want. But God, let me tell you something. The next time you send me anything, don't send it through the government. They kept half the money." The third suggestion is one that I think really needs a lot of attention and which hasn't been discussed here, I don't believe, at this conference. But that is, we are wasting the resources of the criminal justice system, particularly the courts, prosecutors, and to some extent the congressional resources, by criminalizing almost everything in order to show that it's important. We have civil laws, we have civil penalties, we have all kinds of things that don't bring into play the whole panoply of the criminal justice process, which can be used to take care of regulatory offenses, that can be used to take care of a variety of environmental offenses, a whole group of things, where the penalties will be sufficient under the civil law to control and contain the conduct, but at the same time will not tie up the very limited resources that we have to deal with real crime, the malum in se types of crimes like murders, robberies, rapes, drug trafficking, and the like. And I think that this is something that is particularly important. One of the things I've suggested on other occasions is that every congressional act that creates a new crime ought to have a judicial impact statement, so we'll know what that's going to cost in terms of new prosecutors, new court attachés, new judges, new courtrooms, and the like. But I think certainly we can do a great deal in streamlining the criminal law and keep crime for those things that it was really intended to control. And fourth, and I think this is particularly important, we need to continue the efforts of President Reagan and in subsequent terms of presidents to continue to appoint judges and keep the pressure on judges so that there will be a greater emphasis on incapacitating and correcting criminals, and less attention on supervising and imposing restrictions on the police. In this regard, I think that one of the neglected areas of improvement in the criminal justice process is looking at the judicial and correctional role in decision making. If the heads of the large companies in our country had the same record of handling their business as judges do in trying to determine which criminals should be incarcerated, which should be allowed on the street, which criminals should be held for what period of time, who should be granted probation, I can assure you that the Fortune 500 would have about 500 new CEOs. And yet we go about the business of judicial decision making in critical life and death decisions with much less in the way of feedback for judges about the results of their own decisions, much less evaluation, much less training in decision making, and much less data to enable the public to evaluate the quality of the decisions that these judges make. Quite frankly, that's a topic for a whole new speech, and so I won't go any further except to say that it certainly is a very fruitful area to improve the way in which the judiciary and the correctional decisions are made in terms of controlling crime. Well, these are a few modest proposals, as I mentioned, that I hope could enable government at all levels to do a better job of controlling crime and protecting the public safety. One thing I know for sure, and I think you would agree with me, it is critically important that the Federalist Society continue to raise these issues, to continue to keep on a high level the public consciousness that no matter what the danger to society, such as drugs or such as public corruption, which was discussed today, we still have to keep in mind that there is a constitutional framework that there are constitutional limitations, and that there is a constitutional system of dividing these functions between the federal government on one hand and state and local government on the other that must be observed, or else we are heading down a very serious road where problems will continue to arise as they have in the past. I think we would all agree that from a constitutional standpoint, it's the first duty of government to defend the lives and property of its citizens. This goes back to the first establishment of governments to do that, to take that right away from the individual, but in turn, the commitment of government to provide that protection for the individual. By carefully acting under our constitutional framework of government, I believe that this function can be performed much more effectively than it has been in the past. That's why I think that this conference and the issues you're discussing present a very important challenge to citizens and public officials alike. The answer to that challenge will determine how well we as a nation fulfill the mandate that is contained in the preamble to the Constitution. That is, how well we're able to establish justice and maintain domestic tranquility. Thank you.